Order, clerk will note attendance, and we will get underway. Today we have some testimony pursuant to the requests of various members that we hear from certain folks, and I think we'll jump right into that, and then at the end of that, we should have significant time for discussion, deliberations, and see how far along we can get. I'm hoping we can get very far into things today, given the good works we did last time. But I think we will start out with testimony. We have two distinguished legislators here, Representative Lyndon Carlson and Senator Dick Cohen, both of whom I'm proud to say I had a chance to serve with in the House way back when, and they've continued on, and it's very good to have them here. And I know Representative Carlson has another meeting that he has, and since we're in the House chambers, and since I'm a House person historically, I think we'll start out with the House. And ask, later on I'll pay for this from Senator Cohen, I suspect.
We can both come up together, you know.
But you can come up together if you wish, yeah, absolutely. You can interrupt each other and start arguing.
There are times when we're in the majority where we sit side by side in conference committee. And in full disclosure, Tom Berg was my seatmate a couple of years when he was still in the House. I don't know if you remember that.
I do.
But you weren't exactly known at that time for carrying controversial legislation. I think your name was well known throughout the state of Minnesota during that period of time.
Well, I'm hoping before he gets going, Representative Carlson, that we don't get too much full disclosure, because Senator Cohen might tell some stories that we just should not have.
Oh, okay.
But in any event, we welcome to the Minnesota Compensation Council, and we welcome your perspective on our task, which is to recommend to the legislature salaries, as you know, for the executive branch and judicial branch and some units of local government, and we have been working deliberately on this, and we thought it would be wise to hear something from the legislature, and we're extremely pleased that you were willing to come over and talk to us. So with that, Representative Carlson.
Yeah, and by the way, for those of you that I don't know, my time in the legislature has been rather heavily dealing with finance or appropriation issues. Currently, I serve as the minority lead on the Ways and Means Committee, formerly chaired that, and the Finance Committee that you, Mr. Berg, would have known as the Appropriations Committee, and other fiscal committees as well. And so in that role, compensation issues would periodically surface before those funding committees. But I wanted to turn the clock back a little bit and explain why I have some interest in the topic. And Mr. Hubinger sent out an email that I saw, and he asked if we would have any suggestions that we would like to make as members of the House. And so I responded to that. He and I had a conversation, and I did have a couple of suggestions. And he said, well, would you be willing to come in and make a few comments before this group? And I said, sure, I would be happy to do that. But by way of my involvement with personnel issues, it goes way back. I'm a retired teacher, and I first got involved with collective bargaining, wages, salary, fringe benefit issues on our bargaining team for three rounds of contracts before I was in the legislature, and that was kind of my introduction. Then as a member of the legislature, the chair of the Rules Committee approached me one day, and we had been, and this is where I'm headed a little bit later, somewhat negligent in dealing with salaries and fringe benefits for our own House staff, and we had a tendency to leave that go. And what we were supposed to be doing back in those days was providing a salary adjustment for merit at one point in the year, and then cost of living basically at another point in the year. So we were to address it twice within a biennium, within a year. And we were negligent in not doing that. And so the chair of the Rules Committee at the time said, Lynn, would you be willing to chair a special subcommittee of rules dealing with personnel issues? And so I agreed to do that. And by background, we had had quite a turnover. We were losing some of our key people. I remember as a chair of a fiscal committee, our fiscal analysts, they were being hired by the University of Minnesota, various state agencies, and even our own state senate. And so turnover had become an issue. And so one of the things that I did when I accepted that appointment right up front was that I contacted NCSL and asked if they would be willing to do a study for us comparing our compensation for our House employees with what was done in other states and what was done for like positions here within the state of Minnesota.
NCSL stands for National Conference of State Legislatures.
And they were very willing to do that, and they did it, by the way, free of charge. And they put quite a major effort in free of charges because Minnesota is a member of NCSL. So out of that came several things, a salary adjustment, several fringe benefit changes, and then also for the first time ever we hired a director of personnel for the Minnesota House of Representatives, which we still have to this day. Now the unfortunate bit of that story is that that subcommittee didn't continue. You know, the House flips back and forth, and actually it was my party still in control, but a new chair of the Rules Committee came in a couple of years later, some time period later, and decided to no longer have a personnel subcommittee. I did counsel that person in trying to continue it, not that I needed to be the chair necessarily, but I thought it was important to have on a continuing basis those issues addressed. I've also been very active in the Midwest Higher Education Compact, and there I've also frequently been on the compensation committee for the staff for the Midwest Higher Ed Compact. And one of the things that I encouraged them to do and tried to do here in Minnesota when I chaired the House Personnel Committee of Rules was for them to address compensation more frequently than they had. There is a tendency, and I'll just use legislative pay, I know that's no longer your jurisdiction, but you know, not since 1998. So then once it's eventually adjusted, you have these big percentage increases. And then depending on the reporter, you know, they might say, well, this big percentage increase for the pay or compensation for legislators in this example, or you could talk about commissioners or the judges or whatever, because there's been a long period of time where you haven't made an adjustment. So my main message when I talked to Mr. Hubinger was that when you're looking at compensation, that perhaps you make a recommendation that it be frequently adjusted. With the Midwest Higher Education Compact, where I've been more recently involved, we do that each budget cycle, and you know, there are 12 states that are members. Some of the states send a very conservative delegation, some a more liberal delegation, but compensation is never an issue because it's a minor adjustment where you're keeping up as opposed to letting it go for a few years and then having to make a larger adjustment. So that would be my main message here today. And I did check with Mr. Hubinger on the last time he did a study, and he told me it was 2013. So I don't know what your feelings are there, but it probably wouldn't hurt to also periodically do an update, either now or sometime soon, doing a good thorough review of the compensation, just as we did with our House employees, to just see where we stand as a state with our commissioners and judges and other job classifications that you're responsible for. But that's my main message. Do it frequently.
All right.
And well, make those recommendations frequently. And so I'll stop there.
That, I think, is helpful advice. And do you have time? Can you stick around a little bit here First, some questions?
Well, I'm in a leadership meeting that's going as we speak, but I'll try to stay.
Well, let's then, I was going to take a couple of questions quick for Representative Carlson, and then we'll move over to Senator Cohen, if any here.
Sure.
Mr. Meyerson.
I'm puzzled about the salaries that the agency heads get. And as a council here, how are we to sort that out? Is there a way to say that certain agency heads have more difficult jobs, have to put in more hours? There's more or less competition for that position?
From my perspective, dealing with state agencies through the years, not all state agencies are the same in terms of the size and the responsibility. That's where I think perhaps having a good compensation study that looks at not only how we compare, but I would advocate looking at the responsibilities that a given commissioner perhaps has. You know, if you're a commissioner of Health and Human Services, there's probably not a more complex state agency to deal with all the rules and regulations and the knowledge base that you have, coupled with the sheer size of that department. But there are other departments that are comparable to that. But then we do have some smaller departments. So maybe that's something that a good study that would review that aspect of what the responsibilities are would be important. I know as a former teacher, when we were dealing, and I wasn't involved with setting salaries for administrators, we watched them closely because that impacted on our own collective bargaining. But I remember one of the issues in the school district was that some of the high schools, for example, were much larger, had a much larger student body, and there was more activity than some of the smaller ones. Although I always, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, I taught senior high, and I thought probably the toughest job in the entire school district was maybe those principals that were dealing with the middle school, but that's just because of the age group they're dealing with. But I don't think it would be bad at all to take a look at the responsibilities and perhaps make that at least part of the discussion, and then you'd have to make the political decision. Do you treat all commissioners the same, or do you recognize the different responsibilities, size of departments, and so on?
Ms. Olson has a question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, what are your thoughts about how much this council should be considering the political elements of the decision-making? Is that the purview of the legislature? Should we be restricting our recommendations more to not looking at the budget and so forth?
I think you know that looking at the budget and the political side of it, that probably is going to be, regardless of what you do, a legislative part of the debate. I think your role, from my perspective, would be to provide us with what you think is the right thing to do relative to compensation and fringe benefits, and let us take the political side from there, knowing full well it may be political, but that's one of the reasons that I said bottom line. My main message here today was to make those adjustments more frequently so that would lessen the political debate. If there are modest adjustments that are done more frequently to look at the changing responsibilities of a given department, if going back to Mr. Meyerson's question, or perhaps just simply making sure that we're periodically making cost of living increases.
Ms. Janicek has a question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, when you look at the list of jobs we're looking at, are you struck by any that have historically been underpaid or overpaid?
I'm just not sure on that. I think if we look at it historically, let's focus on the commissioners for a moment. I think it would, I would argue that they've probably historically been underpaid relative to the responsibilities they have. But going through all the job classifications, I didn't look at them with that mindset, you know, to try to determine who would be. I don't think anybody's probably overpaid, simply because of the infrequency we make those adjustments.
But that's just off the top of my head. If not, why, Representative Carlson, thank you so much for taking the time to...
And I'd love to hear what my colleague has to say.
Well, you're welcome to stick
around. But I do have to get downstairs, so thank you.
Okay, yes, thank you. And Senator Cohen, thank you so much. Senator Cohen has chaired the Finance Committee in the Senate for some time and very knowledgeable about the political scene as well as the financial scene of the state, and we're glad to have you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And as the chair mentioned, over the years, I've chaired the Senate Finance Committee for a number of years, up until I think about 1 o'clock in the morning on November 9th. I realized I was chairing the Senate Finance Committee. So I just want to make it clear, because the chairman talked about Representative Carlson and the House gets to go first, but historically, of course, I'm a former House member, as you mentioned. So although not quite as long as either yourself or certainly Representative Carlson. A couple thoughts, and I was on the Compensation Council for several years, I forget when, I think 2001, 2002, Mr. Hebinger, I don't know if you recall the change in membership, but I served a term on the Compensation Council, so participating in these conversations, which at that time, of course, also included recommendations relative to legislative pay, I would echo a lot of what Lynn had to say. Although a couple of differences, I would certainly emphasize, as he did, the need to make recommendations on a more frequent basis. All of you have seen the politicization of many aspects of government, whether federal or state, and as a consequence, a lot of the issues. And so there's always that kind of an element. If we talk about commissioners' pay, I hope that I've tried to maybe not be quite as hardcore partisan on some of these issues. It depends on the issue, but certainly we've seen commissioner pay, for instance, get into fights over not which party has the governorship, but hypothetically, if my party doesn't have the governorship, I'm less inclined to support the increases. And that's why I think if you do this on a more frequent basis, if we're looking at a cost of living increase or maybe something a little bit greater, it becomes somewhat more palatable, irrespective of which party is in control of which body of the legislature and which party has the governorship. So I would echo what Lynn said. I think what becomes difficult relative to making determinations in terms of commissioner pay is how you would get into a discussion of what one commissioner should get versus another commissioner. You know, if you take the current structure where you have some of the positions that historically have been considered at a greater level, MMB, revenue, health and human services, I think it's a little bit difficult, unless you're going to get additional staff and spend a lot more time, to get into a lengthy conversation in terms of how would you distinguish the Commissioner of Labor and Industry versus the Commissioner of Administration, or the Commissioner of the DNR versus the Commissioner of the PCA. So I think that's something that gets if you want to spend the time doing that, all the better, but it would seem to me that it would be a huge amount of time beyond what all of you have agreed to do, which obviously is you're doing this as citizens of the state and have other things that you need to do in your lives than do an exhaustive study of the commissioners. I would certainly suggest, Mr. Hebinger, I don't know to what extent NCSL has looked into commissioners around the country, but to the extent that you have comparative data in terms of what states are doing, I think that NCSL usually has some fairly comprehensive information available, both in terms of commissioners, in terms of constitutional officers, and in terms of judicial positions. The email I had from Mr. Hubinger also asked for a little bit of discussion just relative to what we do in terms of the work you've done. I can only speak, I'll speak for myself, in chairing either the full Senate Finance Committee or previously I chaired what's called the State Government Finance Division. When I chaired it, it was about 3.5 times what it was, what it now is. And so I had most of the agencies within the jurisdiction of that division. And I would certainly try to pay attention to the recommendations. So I, in terms of when I had state departments, I had the judicial budget, I had the constitutional officers, I had almost all the commissioners, not everyone, but probably the overwhelming majority of the commissioners. And I would try to pay attention to what came out of the Compensation Council and follow the not necessarily follow the recommendations to the dollar, because obviously in statute, you know, we don't specify. We put kind of the general range of salaries, but would try to incorporate as much of the Compensation Council's recommendations as I could. I've found them historically over the years to be thoughtful and certainly appropriate for what might be done. An issue that comes into play, obviously, and if we talk, let's just talk about one aspect, judicial salaries. There's a request from the Chief Justice in the promulgation of that agency's request for a slight increase in judicial salaries. That tends to be, you know, we have, I think, about 300 judges in the state now, including both trial and appellate. And so when you talk about even a more modest increase, it tends to be a fairly significant dollar amount. You know, if we're in deficit, we probably don't do it. If we have some maneuvering room within the budget, there's a greater chance of doing it. I can't speak for what the majorities in the House and the Senate are looking at doing this year. You know, what I kind of pick up is a bit of a sense that we just gave a pay raise, and this is my paraphrase of what I've heard just talk of, but nothing substantive, that there have been pay raises recently, do we need to do it again, type of thing. And I think part of what probably factors into that is, again, it's a fairly significant dollar amount. Now, when you talk about several constitutional officers, different story. That's fairly insignificant in the context of the state budget. And depending on the size of increases relative to commissioners, that tends to be a fairly insignificant part of the state budget. So the budget comes into play. But I certainly think what I would emphasize is as much work as you can do on a comparative basis. And again, recognize that you have limited hours available. But to the extent that we can see something on a comparative basis, I think that offers some basis that is not as partisan, that, you know, doesn't necessarily, we don't look at it through the prism quite as much as Democratic Governor Dayton as opposed to Republican Governor Plenty, for instance, that if we see that other mid-sized states, Colorado, Washington, Wisconsin, you know, states that are comparable to Minnesota, it becomes a little bit easier then to say, here's what other states are doing, and it takes it a little bit out of the partisan aspect. So I, to the extent you can do it, and again, I have to emphasize that I think it's a little bit of a tall order to suggest you should do this in a comprehensive way that would look at everything, just because you're not going to have the ability, I would guess, to do as much of that. But to the extent you can provide that, and again, that's why I suggest looking at NCSL, because some of that they might already have. But to the extent you can provide that along with your recommendations, I think it would hopefully diminish some of the partisan discussion around what the recommendations might be. This year, and again, not chairing the Finance Committee, but this year we, you know, there is more give on the budget than there has been for a while. We'll see what happens tomorrow morning with the budget forecast. I know the Council of Economic Advisors advising the state's chief economist. And Lynn and I are invited to attend those meetings along with the chair of the Senate Finance and chair of the House Ways and Means. We don't participate we simply got to listen. It's a good education. Their discussion was pessimistic about where the economy might be going, not this year, but in 2018. And to a person, they were somewhat pessimistic. I don't know how that's going to be reflected in the forecast tomorrow. But assuming it continues to be a positive forecast, my hope would be that there's some room to do this. So those are some thoughts. Again, I would echo a lot of what Lynn had to say.
Thank you. Those were very helpful thoughts, because we have worked hard, and I plan to continue to work hard, to keep this sort of in a nonpartisan recommendation to mm-hmm. you. And as Representative Carlson said, you folks can figure out how much partisan stuff you want to apply to it. Are there questions for Senator Cullen on his comments? Anything else you care to add? We welcome your insights.
I wanted to respond more directly to Ms. Janicek with her question to Representative Carlson in terms of what's overpaid, what's underpaid. As I mentioned, I think it's difficult to do a comprehensive study of one commissioner versus another. My sense has been that the commissioners at the lower end tend to be somewhat underpaid, that they get short shrift in recommendations that are made and numbers that are incorporated into the budget. So that's been my sense. I don't have the list in front of me, but you know, in terms of hours, my sense of the commissioners over the years is I can think of maybe a couple of not charlatans, but a couple of commissioners I've been underwhelmed by. But I will tell you, over the years, I don't care who has been the governor, I've been very struck at how hardworking the commissioners are. And people talk about us, the legislature, being hardworking. Okay, but we have a limited period of time that we're supposed to be here. We adjourn May 22nd by the Constitution. The commissioners who are here throughout the year, I've generally been impressed with the group of folks that have been appointed by governors. Again, I could probably think of exceptions to that because I've been around here for a while. But by and large, I think it's I've been struck by how hardworking and competent almost every commissioner is. And that's why I emphasize that I think on the lower end of the scale, I think those people get a little bit short shrift.
Well, thank you so much. Those are very, very helpful comments. And we as I understand this here, we set the range and an increase right. based on range groups 1, 2, and 3 and various people in there. So it helps a little bit. We don't have to go through person by person, as you know. But it's very thoughtful advice for us, so we appreciate it, Senator, very much.
The last comment I'd make is Mr. Chairman, I think you were not in the House, but I was. I was in a House. In the House, it was like when I was a kid, kind of defeated, came back 4 years later, as the chairman knows. And so I think it was that second term in the House when we passed the Compensation Council. And what I remember is it was one of the major fights of, I don't know what happened in the Senate, but in the House it was one of the major fights of the year. And I think the vote board was open for about 2.5 hours, as I recall. But I think the discussion was still a pretty serious discussion. And the board was open, again, for a lengthy period of time. But the discussion on the floor prior to that was, as I recall many years ago, a striking conversation, and one in which the council itself, I think, has more than met the expectations of, I forget who the author was, but the folks who were most involved in the issue.
For those on the council that haven't had much in the way of legislative experience, if that's any of you, when the senator means the board is open, means there's not, there's a tough vote being taken, and there can be some extensive politicking going on the floor of the Senate or the House to get the votes to try to get whatever is up before the group. That means it's a tough, significant fight.
Actually, not in the Senate. Because
the Senator, thank you so much for coming over and spending your time with us. The insights were really very helpful. I appreciate it very much. Right, stay tuned. We'll send you a recommendation.
Great. Thank you. And thanks to all of you for your willing to work on this. the cliche around this place is, oh, this is a thankless job. And at least relative to myself, I take that very much with a grain of salt. There are a lot of things that come with it, but this is a thankless job, and I really appreciate what you're doing.
Thank you. Right, thank you. Thank you very much. Then let's, before we move on to some other testimony here, can I have a quick motion to approve the minutes of February 13th? Representative Mr. Meyerson, did you move that motion? I thought I heard that. Did you second that?
I did second that.
Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, we have a member participating by phone, so under the open meeting law, we have to do that by a roll call vote.
So we're ready to go?
Yes.
Sally, Ms. Olson will call the roll.
Chair Berg.
Aye.
Asp. Brown.
Aye.
Dahlquist.
Aye.
Deckard. Evenson. Fox.
Aye.
Janicek.
Aye.
Lima.
Aye.
Ludwig.
Aye.
Macias.
Aye.
Meyerson.
Aye.
Olson.
Aye.
Robbins.
Aye.
Sharma.
Could not edit.
Sharma.
Aye.
Swanson.
The motion carried. So the minutes are approved. So then let's go ahead.
I just mentioned if folks could not shuffle their papers on the desk or do it as minimally as possible, that would be really helpful to me.
Having been on conference calls, I know that, and probably Ms. Janicek and myself and Mr. Sharma are the culprits because they're closest, at least the speaker, maybe not the microphones, I don't know. I guess it comes from the microphones.
I did a ton of that at the last meeting. So I understand you have to look at your charts and everything, but if it can be minimal, that's great, or lift your pile up. Thank you.
All right. We'll do our best to not shuffle papers around here. And then let's move right into more testimony here. Was a request to hear from the Public Utilities Commission, and Ms. Nancy Lang, the chair of that commission, has been gracious enough to come over and talk with us. And welcome to the Compensation Council. And we can introduce yourself and proceed with your perspective.
Use the microphone, or everyone can hear okay?
I think we can hear okay, but it's being recorded, so we want to,
very good.
To do that.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm happy to be here and answer questions about the Public Utilities Commission and the work that we do and the role of commissioners and the day-to-day operations of our agency. My name's Nancy Lang, and I'm chair of the commission. I was appointed by Governor Dayton in 2013. And with me is Dan Wolf, who I'm sure some of you know, who's our Executive Secretary of the Public Utilities Commission. So I brought just some overview slides so that people can follow along. The commission is maybe one of the state agencies that you haven't heard a lot about, but it touches people's lives in an everyday way. There are five commissioners appointed by the governor. And in statute, there is some rough guidance, if you will, that the governor is given as he makes appointments. The governor, when selecting commissioners, shall give consideration to persons learned in the law or persons who have engaged in the profession of engineering, public accounting, property and utility valuation, finance, physical or natural sciences, production agriculture, or natural resources, as well as being representative of the general public. So pretty broad spectrum of expertise that the governor can draw from as he thinks about appointments, he or she thinks about appointments. We are confirmed by the Senate. We serve staggered 6-year terms. Not more than 3 commissioners can be from one political party, so we are a bipartisan commission. One commissioner must come from outside of the Twin Cities metro area. These are full-time positions. We can be removed, but only for cause. Interestingly, we're not a cabinet-level agency, so we don't interact with the governor. We are quite independent of the governor. The governor's policies do not guide the kinds of decisions that we make, and so we are quite different from many other state agencies. The commission conduct sounds like, you know, you have open meeting laws, we have open meeting laws, because really the commission acts in a mostly quasi-judicial fashion. We do not build the record that comes in front of the commission. The record is built by the parties that appear in front of the commission. Just like a court, the judges hear the evidence that is brought by the prosecution and the defense. We have many more parties than just two that come before the commission. We have strict rules that govern, of course, ex parte communications, that we cannot speak about the issue or the matters that are in front of us with parties that are part of that proceeding. And I'll give you some examples so you can kind of understand the scope of our work and what those proceedings really involve. And on the next slide, you'll see our mission. And what do we do at the Public Utilities Commission? Well, our job is to ensure, as you'll see there, that you have safe, reliable, and affordable energy services and telecom services, and that those are consistent with the state's energy policies. There are some electric and gas utilities that we have oversight over, that we regulate. Those are what we call the investor-owned utilities. Think of them as Xcel Energy, Minnesota Power, Ottertail Power, CenterPoint Energy, Merck, some of the smaller gas utilities, but are still investor-owned utilities. Many, many customers in Minnesota receive their energy services from these investor-owned public utilities. These utilities have been given a monopoly service territory. You are a captive customer of Xcel Energy, for example. Years ago, as the utility system was set up, it made sense to have one provider serve an exclusive group of customers. It didn't make sense to have three different electric companies running power lines down the street, or three different electric companies building generating plants. In exchange for that monopoly service, the commission stands in the place of the marketplace, if you will, and ensures that the rates and the provision of that service is fair to customers, but it's also fair to the utility. Because one of the things that we have to do as a commission is not just look out for the customers, the ratepayers, if you will, we also are responsible to ensure that the utilities have the opportunity to earn a reasonable rate of return, to attract capital, to make the investments that they need to make. So we really have to balance the requests of the utilities alongside that of the needs of the customers. We still have some responsibility over landline telephone service, but not a lot. You know, more and more customers are not using landlines, but those that do still have some quality of service protections with the commission. So what do we do? If you turn to the next slide, the areas of regulation. Really, we are economic regulators. As I said, we oversee the operations, the investments, the practices of the investor-owned utilities. Some of our major areas of work are when utilities file for rate cases. And those are when utilities come to us and say, our costs have increased, we've built generating plants, we've built transmission lines, we're adding technologies to our companies, and we need to recover the costs from our customers. Those are very complex cases. They're long cases. They typically involve many parties. The Chamber of Commerce might intervene. Large power customers might intervene. The Office of Attorney General will participate. The Department of Commerce. And so the record, the point is the record is quite voluminous. And as an example of the financial impact of the revenues that customers generate for utilities, we gathered some data from 2015 that in Minnesota there's 2.7 million electric customers. So those are customer accounts. So if you think about your home, there might be three people in your home, you have one account. Businesses might have, you know, multiple accounts, but those 2.7 million customers for electricity costs revenues generated for the utility, spent about $6.4 billion for electricity. On the gas side, 1.6 million gas customers that we regulate again, generating revenues for those gas utilities of 1.8 million. So you can see it's an appreciable amount of money that flows from customers to utilities, and that the commission oversees that those are reviewed very carefully, and then, as I said, in the case of the rate case, balance between the needs of the companies, the electric and gas utilities, to earn a return, to attract capital, to continue to be a strong energy provider for the state of Minnesota. We have a number of other areas of economic regulation that you'll see listed below. Some of them are $10,000 items, and some of them are billion-dollar items. They can just really vary. We also select resources for the utilities' provision of service. Utilities in Minnesota have a long history of planning very carefully to meet their customers' loads, particularly on the electric side, and they make investments and they make plans. And for those of you who have been keeping attention of this legislative session, there was a lot of discussion about the power plant up in Becker, Minnesota, and what to do about that and what it should be replaced with when those coal units retire. And those are issues that the commission considers very carefully, both from a cost standpoint, a reliability standpoint, and also consistent with environmental statutes. And you can see there's a number of other areas of our regulation I'm happy to answer if you're interested in, but that deal with the provision of renewable energy services or renewable energy generation. Minnesota statutes require a certain amount of renewable energy generation, and that's our responsibility as a commission to see that the companies are meeting those standards, or if those standards are prohibitive for whatever reason, you know, they don't have access to the generation or it's too expensive, they can seek an off-ramp from the commission. But to date, none of our utilities have done that, in large measure because they've been able to procure large amounts of wind energy in a very cost-effective manner.
Well, our mission here is not to get into any, and I would hope we don't get into that, questioning about this energy source versus that energy source and mm-hmm. that kind of thing. Ours is to look at compensation for the commissioners
sure.
as part of the range of Group 2, as I understand it.
Right.
So if you can, this is very helpful to give us an overview about what you do.
Right.
So we can consider that when we set the range, but we're not going to get into
it. No, I know that. Yeah. And I just was trying to kind of give you a range of the kinds of decisions that we're making.
Helpful.
Yeah. And lastly, I'll touch on the energy infrastructure certification, siting, and routing. That's another big responsibility that we have. If you think about the transmission lines that you see as you drive down a freeway, we have responsibility to make sure that those transmission lines are needed, that they're part of a reliable service study, that the costs for those transmission lines are appropriate, and then really the most challenging part in some ways is the siting and routing of that energy infrastructure. So you think about transmission lines, you think about power plants, wind farms, solar farms, and oil pipelines. We also have responsibility for oil pipelines, which, as you know, is a very contentious issue, strong feelings on both sides of the equation, if you will, for pipelines, pro and con. So those are the kinds of decisions that the commission makes. What do I do every day? As a commissioner, I do a lot and lot of reading and record study. I work with our staff, who are subject matter experts, to prepare me so that I understand the record very completely. We have hearings. We ask a lot of questions. We do briefings then with our general counsel sometimes, because really, as a commission, Our job is not to create policy. Our job is to implement the statutes as they've been written. So, you know, many, many times we have to really parse that statutory language, especially if it's new statutory language, and be very careful that we're interpreting our decisions within the context of the law. So that's an overview, very generally, of what the commission does, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for that, and I assume Mr. Wolf would answer questions if we have some directed back there. We thank you for coming over here, too, and being available to us. Questions by commissioner or by councilman?
I have a bunch. We can just run through them. Can you give us a sense of how many cases you guys have to decide every year?
Ooh, I think it's about approaching 2,000, isn't it, Dan?
Yeah.
I think last year it was around 1,900 cases, and some of those cases, as I said, are fairly routine filings, if you will, for a better lack of a better term, that utilities file in response to either statute or prior orders of the commission. Some of the filings are very, very large, like I mentioned, the rate cases. Some of the resource planning decisions that we have are really voluminous, but could follow up with that.
No, that's good. This is ballpark to better understand it.
Yeah.
And then, so if a consumer has a complaint, they would file it with the PUC. What's that caseload like?
You know, I did have a slide in here, and I bet I didn't bring it, on the number of customer complaints. I don't know if you remember that off the top of your head, Dan. And I can certainly provide that as a follow-up.
No, I'm just trying to get a sense of things.
Yep.
And then my final...
Did you want to answer that, though?
Go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, for the record, Dan Wolf, the Executive Secretary at the Public Utilities Commission and members of the council. It depends upon the level of the contact, but we have as many as 30,000 contacts a year from customers, but in terms of a formal filed written complaint where a person has to waive their privacy for their data so we can contact the utility and deal with that, it's probably around 2,000 cases a year that are formal complaints with the Consumer Affairs Office.
Okay.
And these could be customers who, you know, got disconnected, or they have a billing dispute, or, you know, they're meter isn't working and they're not getting satisfaction, so they can file with us.
All right, a couple more questions, and I will tell you where I'm coming from. I'm coming from the observation that this is a hot, sought-after job, being a PUC commissioner, and that I've known commissioners who've gone overseas on big trips, long trips, while they're serving the commission, that it's not a full-time job. So, here's the question I have to try to measure that against what's actually happening. Do the commissioners go to the office every day?
Yeah, commissioners do. We have one commissioner who's out of state or out of the Twin Cities, and he works at home maybe 1 to 2 days a week. Because so much of our work is reading and record review and understanding the soup to nuts of the case, if you will. I think, you know, that's probably, you know, a job that can be done at home. And so we do have the out-of-state commissioner who does spend some time at home.
Not out of state, but outstate.
Outstate, excuse me.
Greater Minnesota.
Greater Minnesota, yeah.
Final question. Do you think that the commissioners are overpaid, underpaid, or is it just about right?
Well, that's a great question. Before the last pay increase, let's see, now I'll just start out. When I was hired as a commissioner, our salary was $88,000 a year. We're now at $140,000, which, you know, is an appreciable increase. I would say if you look at utility commissioners around the country, and I heard the previous legislators say, you know, draw some comparisons from other states, I would say we're in the ballpark, maybe a little bit on the high end compared to other state commissions, but that's almost anecdotal. That's not a scientific survey of all 50 states. Certainly at 88,000, 100,000, even 120,000, I think the commission was, in Minnesota, was well underpaid compared to other states. And I will say that I think the commission in Minnesota works very hard. I talked to some of my colleagues in other states, and I don't know if their statutes are not as ambitious or if their utilities are not as active, but I feel like when I talk to some of my fellow commissioners in other states that, you know, we have a big caseload and we have a very active industry that we're regulating.
Are there other questions? Yes.
I know you can probably only speak to your area, but do you have a sense of what the competition is like for these positions, or how many?
Well, it's interesting. Ms. Janicek, I think, is correct that with the salary increase, I think there's a lot more interest in the Public Utilities Commission. When I applied to the commission, I talked to a number of people before I applied who really care a lot about the commission and the decisions it makes. And they said, but I would never do it because I'd have to take such a big pay cut. Now, at $140,000 a year, that's a very different situation. And would those same people say that? I don't know. I don't know their relative benefits and salaries. You know, some people work for law firms and, you know, are making appreciably more than that. But certainly, you know, at the salary that I was appointed at, there were anecdotally people telling me I can't take that job given the current job and expertise that they had.
Ms. Olson.
Mr. Chair. I'm Ms. Fairley. Nice to see you. Can you describe a little bit the additional duties that the chair of the PUC has? So you have five commissioners who really aren't analogous so much to agency heads, which we also call commissioners, I would say, as to trial court judges. Is that fair?
I think that is fair. I mean, Mr. Wolf has the responsibility to manage the staff and run the agency. So certainly, as you think about, well, our counterpart at Department of Commerce, Commissioner Rothman, I think he has, you know, a lot of responsibility to administer the agency. He has a lot of deputy commissioners as well. We have a staff of 55 people right now, and so that is Dan's primary responsibility. As chair, I do work with Dan, the executive secretary, quite closely on agency administrative matters. We talk about personnel issues that arise. We talk about scheduling issues. We talk about, you know, staff morale and how to ensure that it's high and good. We talk about retaining good employees and what we might need to do and how we post jobs, where we post jobs. So I would say, you know, on a daily basis, Mr. Wolf and I are in contact about the administration of the agency. In terms of chairing the commission, there are many times that the chair can make singular decisions, if you will, about the content of a notice. For example, we're going to send out a notice that says commission is seeking information on the following things. And that, because we act in a formal and in a record-driven way, we have to do that in a very kind of prescribed format. Mr. Wolf will check with me because we often delegate to the executive secretary who works with the staff on the specific wording of that notice. He would come to me and say, notice look okay, do we need to modify anything, do we need dates differently, and we'll work through some of that. I would say the other thing that the chair does is run the meetings, which, you know, can be an interesting endeavor in and of itself because we deliberate in public. We do not make decisions behind closed doors. These are very impactful decisions on people's lives. It's an open meeting. And so when I walk into the commission meeting on Thursday, I might guess where the other commissioners are at, but I don't know where they're at. And so we deliberate in public, and sometimes that's super easy because we all agree, and sometimes it's not so easy because we have different opinions. Although I will say most of our decisions are either unanimous or almost unanimous decisions. But as chair, I need to execute that public discussion that the commissioners are having and drive it towards reaching consensus if we can, and if not, making a decision that, you know, is going to be supportable by the law and the record. So that's another duty of the chair.
So just for clarification, you have the same caseload as the other commissioners, but then you do these additional things? Is that...
Yeah, I think that's correct.
And is there any compensation difference for the chair?
No, there isn't in Minnesota. Well, you know, that's interesting. Other states, the chair might be compensated more. I do know of, like, Michigan, and I think maybe Iowa, the chair is compensated more. Other, like Wisconsin, they're all compensated equally. And so I think it depends, you know, just on the decision of the legislature. And the
any other questions
Yes, I do. You said roughly you didn't know of the pay of other public utility commissions in other states, but...
No, I do have a sense, kind of.
All right. Yeah. Well, that's fine. Are there other utility commissions that are similar, that you would consider similar, I guess, just from looking at the other 49 states, mm-hmm. in terms of how they operate, the kind of laws that they're operating under?
I would say it was interesting that, was it Representative Carlson mentioned Oregon and Washington and Colorado? Mm-hmm. I think those are states that have very large utilities in them. They have a lot of energy statutes that govern those utilities. Some states have a lighter touch through their statutes on their utilities. Some states have a little more direction to their energy utilities. Colorado also shares Public Service Company of Colorado, which is a part of Xcel Energy, so they have another big utility, electric utility, like we do. I think Wisconsin, is similar to some extent.
Are they similar in terms of makeup, size of commissions and...
You know,
so
commissions can really vary. Some commissions have three commissioners. Some, I think the most is seven, but most have five. South Dakota and North Dakota elect their commissioners, so they're public offices, which is a different twist on things. I think South Carolina elects their commissioners. So there's little different flavors in each state, but typically... you know, 3 to 5 commissioners per utility commission. And some commissions have different jurisdictions. I think the Illinois Commission, I feel really bad, regulates taxi cabs, which would seem like a very complex, but their agency also has like 700 people in it, and our agency has 55 staff people.
Other questions? Mr. Meyerson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hubinger. I'm taking a look at this agency head salaries schedule, and it's grouped. And a couple of questions I have. Is the PUC the only agency for which there are five commissioners? So when we look at the 140,000, it's 140 times five?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. And for these other agencies, are the deputy commissioners, whatever, how are their salaries determined?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Meyerson, deputy commissioner's salaries are set within a range within a compensation plan that's adopted by the Minnesota Management and Budget. And I think we sent you a list of the top 100 state paid employees. I think they top out at around 140,000.
Thank you.
Other questions? Yes, Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Lang, just a couple of quick ones. Do you regulate internet services?
No.
How about cooperatives?
No, we don't. Although there is one cooperative, Dakota Electric, which is actually a fairly large rural, it's not rural, but it's an electric cooperative. that chooses to be rate regulated by the commission. Cooperatives have that choice. I guess years ago there was a major dispute with their board over rate regulation, and they turned it over to the Public Utilities Commission.
And then can utilities pancake their rate increase requests?
When you say pancake...
Can they have more than one in front of the commission at each time?
No.
So it's just one?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Yes.
I just have a quick question. When you mentioned earlier that there's 2,000 or so cases this year, and some were routine and some were not, what percentage of those would you consider ballpark figure were routine? And are those handled mostly by staff and the larger caseload handled between the five commissioners?
No, we see almost, I would say, 95 to 98% of the cases. There is what's called a consent calendar, and we have a commissioner who is in charge of the consent calendar. So for things that are very, very routine, those issues would go on the consent calendar. We all review the consent calendar and make sure that, A, we think it should be on the consent calendar, and then that commissioner can sign off on those. But that's, I would say, about 2% of the cases in front of us. And so really the bulk of the cases come before the commission. There's a record developed. We hear them at our public meetings on Thursday morning. And parsing out, you know, some of the less involved cases, I would say, those are about 30%. And I would say the more complicated cases are really the other 40, the math isn't adding up. So if it's about 30%, it'd be about 60% that are more. That's kind of my rough estimate of.
Other questions? If not, why, we thank you very much for coming, Ms. Lang and Mr. Wolf. Thank you. It's very helpful to us to learn about that, and it's good. So.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you. And we'll. Then continue on. I think you're taking testimony, and then maybe we'll take a break after that. The Metropolitan Airports Commission is here, and I see three members out there. We have two chairs, so you can pick whichever ones a colleague to come up to Mr. Killen here.
Chairman Berg, I think I drew the short straw to get to come and comment on my board chair salary today, so they're all going to hide in the back. My name is Mitch Killian. I'm the Director of Governmental Affairs with the Metropolitan Airports Commission. I've been with them for about 23 years, and I've worked under four board chairs and quite a few different board members. And I did have a chance to talk to our board chair and our current CEO, and they thought that I'd be well-suited to come over and kind of give you a little bit of an overview of the commissioner, the chairman's role, and also some of our board members' roles as well. Many of you are probably
Let me stop you for 1 second there. Our role here is to set the salary of the chair, as I understand.
The maximum
in a range. So I'd like to try to keep, we don't need to get the whole nine yards about all of the airports commission thing, but enough so that we can understand that, and particularly the chair.
Understood, Mr. Chairman. In fact, what we thought we would really focus on is that role of the chair and kind of policy development. And I think some of you are very familiar and work with us regularly, that the Airports Commission was created in 1943 and was set up to run the airports in the metropolitan area. So we have Minneapolis International and six general aviation airports. I really am happy to answer a lot of the operational questions or size difference compared to others if you have them. But I thought what we would do is focus on kind of the role of the chair, and to do that, it works well for us to talk about policy development within the Airports Commission, and that'll kind of play out how the board chair works into that. So the chairman of the board, actually, we do with the commission is we have a 15-member board. 13 of them are appointed by the governor, including the chairman, and then the Minneapolis mayor has one appointment, and the St. Paul mayor has one appointment. The commission serves as a full body. And then below that, we break into three different committees. We have a Planning and Environment Committee, a Management and Operations Committee, and a Finance Committee. And there's different chairmen for those committees as well. And so like the legislature, where things work their way through a committee process on a policy development issue, issues will automatically go through one of the committees before it gets to the full commission, so we have good public kind of airing of issues. But below that, like a normal local unit of government, we have those same laws that apply to us. If we're passing ordinances or passing issues, we have to follow the public hearing process like other local units of government. And so below our committee structure then is that public hearing process and the formal public hearing process. Sometimes our committees will actually serve as those public hearing officers. And then I want to go a little bit deeper for our policy development, and then I'll work my way back up into where the chairman comes in, is that we set up lots of advisory boards and groups that are below that public hearing process to take input and communication tools. As you can imagine, noise around MSP Airport. We have a noise oversight committee that kind of sits out and meets with citizens and users of the airport to work through noise issues. We have a taxi cab advisory commission that works through taxi cab issues and things. We have a reliever airport advisory commission made up of tenants on all of our reliever airports. So lots of issues are worked down there. And then in your day-to-day operations, it's staff working with tenants and citizens on all types of issues. So going back up through the chain, you've got that citizen to staff involvement. And then when you go to those advisory commissions, we usually put a commissioner on those boards to be part of that dialogue. Sometimes it's the chairman, but lots of times it's one of the other commissioners that's closely related to the issue. And then the commissioners that serve on those committees might serve as the public hearing officer, the chair of that. And then there's those three committees, the management and operations and finance and planning and environment, they hold issues as well. And then it finally goes up to the full board. The reason I'm kind of laying this out for you is at any given time, our commissioners all could find themselves more busy than others. If you're chairing the Management Operations Committee, when we recently took up the Uber and taxi cab debate, which was about a year and a half of a lot of staff time and a lot of commissioners' time, that particular issue went through our Management and Operations Committee. So that issue, the Management Operations Chair, put a lot of time into that issue. Right now we're going through an airport improvement issue out at Lake Elmo Airport. That's going through a major public hearing process, Met Council long-term comp plan review. That issue is falling underneath our Planning and Environment Committee chair. And so what I'm pointing out to you is that all of our commissioners are heavily involved. Our our chairman of our commission might at times take on some of those public hearing officer chair roles and things, but it really is spread out through the whole commission, and then it goes up when it's finally at that final top board level. When issues are finally heard with the 15-member board, that's where the board chair comes in. So I wanted to kind of give you that background because it kind of lays out how we're structured and where the board chair really comes in, and that they're really spread out. And I know this is not underneath the purview of the board, but I was actually, our current board chairman said, it's more about the $50 per diem that we're concerned with than the board chair piece. And I know that that's not underneath your purview, but we have lots of commissioners working very hard on issues. And I think you guys are underneath the $50 per diem too. So you probably are well aware of that, but I wanted to make sure and just mention that. What I did was, so that it didn't just come from one staff guy's comments to you today about compensation levels. Over the weekend, I talked to our existing board chair, the past board chair, Jack Lanners, who was appointed by Tim Pawlenty, our CEO, Jeff Hamill, who was the CEO for over 30 years, and our current CEO, Dan Bovin, and asked them about the compensation level. And hands down, the simple comments were overall, they think it's in the appropriate range, and they think it's fine. It's worked out really well for us with our structure. In fact, Jack Lanner's comments were probably the best ones, and he said that the board chair really just runs the chair, and that's a part-time public service position. The CEO needs to run the operation, and we need to be careful not to confuse those two roles, from the CEO to our piece. So overall, again, this isn't coming from Mitch Killian, Director of Governmental Affairs. I surveyed a few of our folks, and they thought that we are right in the right category, and it separates those duties pretty well. And our existing board chair was pretty comfortable with where we're at. So we've been happy with and think that the current arrangement has served us well. If you're familiar that the last time that there were increases, I think that our board chair went from approximately $20,000 a year to $30,000 a year. Give or take a little bit in there. That was a year and a half ago or so. And we felt that that's just fine. But again, I would again, not in your purview, but they all said that $50 per diem isn't really justifying. When you're chairing one of those other committees and you get wrapped up in Uber and taxis for a year and a half, how much time some of those board members have put in on issues, or if you're from South Minneapolis and you happen to be on our board, how much more you're going to put in on noise or and different issues. When we expanded Flying Cloud, the Eden Prairie area commissioner took on a much bigger role for that term of being the commissioner. So happy to stand for questions if you have any.
All right. Thank you for that quick synopsis. We appreciate that. Mr. Fox. Dr. Fox.
This is a quasi-government organization, I guess, or set up as an authority. Is that the proper term?
Set up as a public corporation.
Okay. And who across the country is similar to you guys?
Great question. Thanks. And this is where I didn't want to bog you guys down. But typically, if you really looked at United States of America's airports, they're owned by local units of government. And so most of them are small. So if you go to Brainerd, it's a joint venture of Brainerd and Crow Wing County. If you go to St. Cloud, it's the city of St. Cloud. And if I move to big airports, the city of Chicago, ultimately, the Chicago City Council makes those decisions. Los Angeles is Los Angeles County. Miami is Miami-Dade County. There are authorities, and there's a slow transition to more authorities like us where you could break away. And oftentimes what you see is it might be county board members get to appoint a couple, maybe the governor gets to appoint some, or a city council's, and it's just mixture of appointees, or the county board members themselves will serve on it. So I think that your next question might lead to pay and structures of them. If you're a county board member and then you serve on the airport board, you don't get more pay and things to be on it in most cases. You're going to have it. If you go to the big port authorities of New York and New Jersey or Seattle, where the airport system is one part of that, so the New York Port Authority is really run by, the airports are run by the Port Authority, so they're running toll roads and bridges, the shipping ports and airports. Now those become paid positions and things in that role, but for the most part, an unofficial survey is lots of them aren't getting additional compensation to be on the airport board.
So I take from that this is kind of an unusual organization. I mean, if you look at Wayne County, that's an airport authority. They're probably appointed by the Wayne County board.
I believe it's a mixture again, and that is the county board gets some. I think that maybe the city and maybe the governor's office maybe has some. So it's a mixture of appointees.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions, Ms. Janicek?
Mr. Killian, I certainly recognize that the per diems are beyond our jurisdiction. However, we get to write a report, and we have talked about adding footnotes and recommendations beyond our purview. To that end, can you give us some history of why it's always been just the chairman that gets paid? And as you know, I'm intimately familiar with the committee structure. I mean, some of those people work more than the chairman. There doesn't seem to be rhyme or reason to paying the chairman, but not the other commissioners, particularly the ones who chair the workhorse committees.
Sarah, I'm glad that you point out the difference, because we do have some hard working chairmen on those other committees, really, that put in a lot of time. I think that I don't have the history, but if I had to kind of venture to guess a little bit about it, your role is to be the chair of that board, and so you really are managing that board. If you took away all those constituent service issues and things, there is a special role in managing that 15-person board and making sure and setting committee assignments. Our bylaws right now call for that the chair sets the committee assignments, appoints the chairs. There are some special pieces to being the chair of it. But again, each one of them take it on different. This particular chair lives in South Minneapolis, and so every time they go to the coffee shop on Saturday morning, they're working, right? I mean, as you can imagine. And so
Has anyone ever taken a run at trying to change that at the legislature?
So I've been with the airports commission for 23 years, and I haven't heard of anybody
ever
trying
to. That's my memory too. Yes. Okay.
And there are, as I understand it, Ms. Janicek raised the issue or mentioned that the PUC people are as a sought-after position. It's my understanding that the MAC commissioners are also a pretty sought-after position, even with the compensation such as it is. Is that right?
Chairman Berg, I believe so. On the number of applicants, I'm not sure. But it is, we get good people that apply to be on our board. And I think it has to do with the pride of being part of the airport. Aviation's kind of a little bit the sexy, fun things, but everybody's got pride in the airport. But our annual operating budget is about $350 million. We're doing a capital budget of any place from $100 million in an off year to $400 million in capital budget. So when you compare that to the state's bonding bill, we're doing $400 million in construction some years. Being on that board, it's pretty important. And so we get good people that want to be involved in those decisions.
Other questions for Mr. Killian? Yes.
Mr. Chairman and Director Killian, or Chair, I was wondering, you mentioned that it's responsible for MSP and then it cooperates with some general aviation airports in the area. Then you mentioned reliever airports. Are those broader than the region then? And what's the role in coordinating with those reliever airports?
Thank you, Council Member and Chair. So the Metropolitan Airports Commission is responsible for MSP, and then we have six general aviation airports in the metropolitan area, starting from Flying Cloud on one side to Lake Elmo, Air Lake, those are our jurisdictions. So we're the local unit of government that owns and operates them. That those are our responsibility. The employees that manage those airports are ours, and they are. And so we call them relievers because they relieve congestion at MSP, or Lake Elmo really is a reliever to St. Paul downtown, and that is relieving so that you don't have too much traffic at St. Paul downtown, so Lake Elmo becomes an important tool. That term reliever is universal kind of for our general aviation airports.
Thanks.
Other questions? Yes, Ms. Dahlquist.
Do you ever have any involvement with like the city-owned airports or anything? Do they come to you for guidance or...
Great. I appreciate the question because we're proud of this fact, and that although we're a metropolitan agency, we think that air service is important to Minnesota, and part of our task is to promote air service for the whole state. So we serve on the Minnesota Council of Airports, where we work closely with airport managers around the state. But we even have a special subset of that group called the Local Air Service Action Committee, and it's airports that have air service in Minnesota. And we definitely take a lead role in that with Rochester and the Duluth, Bemidji, International Falls, Hibbing, and Thief River Falls all have commercial air service. A lot of that commercial air service is coming through our airport. And so we work closely and meet with them regularly, both the airport managers and even city councils and mayors, to work on their air service issues, and we think it's important. It's not competition for us. It's good for Minnesota, so we do work closely with them.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes.
I just have one final question. For when you mentioned it's a part-time role, which we're aware of, how part-time would you consider it? Like, if you could break it down into number of hours per...
That's interesting. I skipped that over my notes. That the $30,000 doesn't come close to paying very good compensation if you're going by how much time put in. But I kind of compared it to legislators. As you know, some legislators will meet with everybody that comes to talk to them and will hold open hours all the time, and they're open. And another legislator says, send me some paper on it, I'll read it, and I'll listen to testimony in committee. You can get a pretty big variance, and they're pretty big variance of board members, but a pretty big variance of even chairs. This particular chair, I'd say, is well undercompensated if you're going by hours put in, because he lives in South Minneapolis, and he's a very engaging guy. So he stepped up and is going to be on our concessions committee that's coming up and things, and so it's hard for me to estimate the hours because there's such a big variance in it. But if you were just going on hours, first of all, again, I go back to our full board members, they're way undercompensated, and even our commission chairman is probably undercompensated if you're trying to do it on hours put in, because he really is putting in a lot. When you think about, well, on our taxi and Uber hearings, we held two four-hour hearings that were held. That's before you got into the committee cycle and the full commission. And on top of that, you were constantly out meeting with taxi cab drivers. The Teamsters were representing the taxis. That took a lot of meetings of putting together people and things. And so I don't have a good number for you, but I hope I'm giving you a feeling for how much time really. You could take meetings every Saturday morning if you wanted at your local coffee shop if you're engaged in one of these issues.
But is that the chair?
It's the chair, but it can definitely be other commissioners.
Was it the chair holding the taxi hearings?
In this case, that was our Management and Operations Committee chair that was closest to it.
Okay. Okay. I'm interested in how, maybe you've never had to look at this particular issue, but how you might compare that chair position to the chair of the Minnesota State Board of Trustees and the University of Minnesota Board of Regents, both entities having significantly larger budgets than the MAC, and comparable, at least comparable, bonding project lists. So what would be, and those are not paid, so I'm just curious, other than the $55 a day that you're talking about.
So since about 4 or 5 days ago, when Greg and I started talking about this, I think we kicked that around internally a little bit and tried to get a feel for that. And the one piece for us is this aviation expertise and the operational day-to-day pieces that we run, building runways and construction, is so specific that that really gets pushed over to the administration and handed off. And you're not constantly dealing with a public policy decision like a Met Council head might be light rail. How much more you're involved with just light rail and the politics and the policy of light rail probably takes a little bit more. But I think that we're safer with saying we understand ours and we think our system works well and that it doesn't have to be elevated to too high of an elevation to a different point. Now, for us to comment on Minsky or Met Council, I just don't think that we're as familiar as we should be to know those differences.
Any other questions? If not, why, we thank you very much for coming over, and this was very enlightening, I think, about how things work, and appreciate your being able to condense it for us. That was very helpful, and we'll be in touch.
Okay. Thank you. Please call us anytime if you have questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Then I think we will take, members of the council here, this is a good time, let's take a short break. Come back here at 25 minutes to, how's that? And it gives us about 9 minutes by my looking at the clock. Mr. Rob?